Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the third episode of our In Diverse Company podcast. Today's episode is about developing inclusive cultures within SMEs and startups. And so if you are listening to this for the first time, we have covered inclusive cultures in the previous two episodes, but from a different perspective and certainly not within the context of SMEs and startups. So this should be a really fascinating conversation. I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm really excited to introduce our speaker for today by the name of Luke Windeatt Dickens. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly, Luke.
You did well, Lloyd.
And so what I'm going to do as a kind of starting point is I'm going to ask Luke to just introduce himself and tell us a bit about the organization he works for. So over to you, Luke.
Thank you, Lloyd. Pleasure to be here and thank you for the invitation. So quick highlights of me. I live in London. I'm a West Country boy, proudly originally. I've spent a lot of time living abroad over the years. My family actually moved to California 18 years ago. So I've sort of had a sort of double life across the pond. I'm engaged to my fiance, Sarah. She's a marketing director for a SaaS business. She's pregnant with our first child, which we're expecting at the end of the summer. So yeah, I say I live in London, but we're going to be doing the commuter thing in the not too distant future, as tends to be the way. And yeah, what else about me? Not much interesting. I suppose I've been vegan for several years and definitely before it was trendy as well. That's a bit about me. I lead on global enterprise sales in the private sector for Good Shape. Good Shape, we're a health management platform. We help employers support their people's physical, mental, and social well-being. So we've supported 800,000 employees through more than 23 million health events. And we have the largest database on workplace health and well-being in the UK. Our platform connects the employees of organizations to the right health services at the right time. Often that's not the case, and I can get into lots of detail why that is, but ultimately that results in faster assessments, treatments, return to work, engagement, reduces attrition, prevents the same illnesses happening time and time again, particularly if you think about mental health. We provide 24/7 clinical support, and most key to our services is that we measure absence and well-being data to give employers insights into what's working and what's not, because it's been a lot of money invested in the well-being sector, but I think we're at a stage where there's a bit of apathy from the CFOs because the measurement behind the data hasn't been very efficient, but it's definitely heading in that direction. Ultimately, we see health as being a business advantage, and Good Shape's here to help organizations invest in it in the right way.
Thank you. And congrats on imminent fatherhood.
Thank you. Yes. First one. It's nervous and excited in equal measure.
Yeah, I'm sure. Brilliant. So thank you for giving us a brief introduction to yourself and also to Good Shape, the organization that you work for at the moment. And so really what I want to do now is kind of delve a bit more into some of the strategies and initiatives that Good Shape have deployed to help develop an inclusive culture. So it'd be great to kind of hear your thoughts on that and to just elaborate further on the things that you have been doing.
Sure, yeah. I can start quite high level, I think. We're an SME business ultimately, and actually what we do is very sort of people-centric and focused on helping ultimately enterprise type businesses as well as NHS sized organizations to support their people's health and well-being, and ED&I is a big focus for us in that as well, and we partner accordingly because ED&I and well-being are kind of two sides of the same spoon. But often, as is the case with smaller SMEs, budget restraints and lack of team size and things like that, you know, has an impact. You know, as much as we are great at servicing our customers, looking internally, sometimes it can take a little longer to get these things right. But what we did do over a year ago was bring in our Chief People Officer, Dorothy Day, Dot. What she did initially was conduct a cultural audit and gather data to help us understand what matters most to our people. That's where you've got to start, right? And we'll be honest, we didn't really have this sort of thing in place before. So we've definitely been on a maturity curve over the past year. Our people team created a new cultural narrative, a tone of voice, interdepartmental squads to solve common problems, looking to co-create our values and behaviours. As some examples, since then, we've changed our tone of voice and our communications are much more sort of people-centric and inclusive. As another example, flexible working is now the norm for us. We seek to accommodate all requests in this regard. What we've come to know is this is a big ticket item for the majority of our people. This came out loud and clear in audits and surveys, and I can talk more about this. But, you know, this is ongoing. We're currently in the design and build phase of this strategy, and it will continue to evolve.
That's really interesting. And I guess there's a number of things that I'm hearing there. You know, firstly, the kind of starting point with regards to the culture audit to understand what has worked in the past, but also where the areas for improvement. And then also, I picked up on an interesting point that you mentioned with regards to budget constraints. And I think, you know, that's probably something that maybe we don't always sort of appreciate as much. And that is that, you know, clearly that the unique context within, you know, SMEs and startups is that, you know, there is the sort of, you know, not to say that it doesn't exist in large organizations, but maybe sometimes you're closer to the cold face of the budget sort of practicalities, if you like, in terms of making those things happen. And I just wonder whether you could potentially sort of expand on that in terms of actually how do you overcome or how do you justify sort of taking that kind of almost long-term approach of implementing, you know, a strategy and initiatives, which sometimes can be almost kind of paradoxical to the sort of short-term budget challenges that a business faces.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, for the record, I've worked in different sized organizations. I've worked in enterprise businesses most of my career. This is the second time I've worked for an SME. And it's really, you know, it's great. It's great to sort of had that experience in, you know, in both types of organization. It's a good question. I mean, first and foremost, you know, bringing in a heavy hitter type chief people officer does help, because obviously their experience and knowledge in terms of strategy that they've accomplished previously, obviously they bring that mindset and that experience into the organization to help smaller businesses maybe understand what is needed to be sophisticated and to achieve short, medium, long-term goals. But I think what it comes down to is, as I mentioned, Dot and the people team conducted this discovery audit. And I think it then came down to boiling it all down to, you know, what are the key objectives? What's the sort of crawl, walk, run approach? And actually, I think it's more of that reverse engineering. You know, if in 3 years, the target operating model of the business is to be here to achieve this, reverse engineering is absolutely critical. I think, you know, when you're working for an SME, what you notice is everybody's obviously in it together. I think there's less sort of interdepartmentality in a sense, because we're all sort of singing from the same hymn sheet. There's less sort of cross-department politics. And therefore, I think the goals of the organization are much more at the forefront of everybody's mind. You know, I think there's that term that like everybody's in BD, everybody's in business development. And I think therefore, you know, whether you're leading on cultural changes from an ED&I wellbeing perspective or something completely different, I think that the objectives are quite they're loud and clear. Therefore, I think if you're looking to achieve certain things in a certain period of time, it's always about aligning the strategy internally with what the business's objectives are in terms of that target operating model. But I do believe it's this reverse engineering. It's almost saying, if we want to achieve X by, you know, year three, then what's right in front of us? How do we take the first step? What's the 10th step? What's the 20th step? And I think it's just helping to sort of crystallize that and boil it down in terms of what that particular department's trying to achieve internally in terms of cultural change and that sort of thing, as we discussed. But as I said, absolutely making sure that aligns with the business's objectives. And actually, if you can showcase that it does align with a necessity for budget to be included or further executed, because it does have a material benefit and it works both ways, and I think that's how you go about achieving it. But ultimately, you know, communication within this business is key and critical, and there's a constant dialogue in terms of multiple strategies that are on the go at any given point.
And so I guess then kind of delving a bit sort of deeper into that, what approaches have Good Shape taken to promote well-being amongst their employees? And how has this aligned with your strategy and initiatives for developing an inclusive culture? And I guess the reason why I kind of asked the question is, you know, you're in the business of well-being, right? And, you know, you're kind of helping organizations to tackle some of these kind of challenges that they experience with regards to, you know, health and well-being of staff. And so I guess kind of almost sort of taking a kind of internal lens, you know, how are you sort of approaching that as well? Would be really good to kind of hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think first and foremost, that, you know, as I mentioned, there was the, you know, going through discovery, et cetera, but there have been plenty of surveys, you know, to really truly understand what matters most to people. Off the back of that, we've set up a wellbeing champion squad as one example to raise awareness of topics of interest. We then conducted multiple workshops as a result of what people wanted. As an example, I can think of, we've got menopause warriors, we've got nutrition groups, pregnancy groups, childcare groups. Ultimately, we focus on what what people are telling us. As I mentioned, you know, smaller businesses and businesses like ours, we have great products and great services, and we align fantastically with our customers. In terms of our own Good Shape Central platform, which is, you know, an incredible piece of SaaS as a service software, we didn't have this internally sort of a year ago, but now we do. So it's, I think it's really critical that if we're singing from the same hymn sheet and advocating for, you know, excellent well-being approaches to our customers, and we need to make sure that that is brought in-house as well and done internally. So having access to our software platform that is the sort of, you know, the diamond in the crown in terms of what we supply to our customers, you know, it was very important that we had that internally as well. And you can sense that it kind of takes away some of the, I wouldn't say hypocrisy, I don't think that's the right word, but it certainly takes away the elephant in the room. It's almost like, you know, if we're giving this fantastic software to our customers, and surely our people should have that internally as well.
Mm.
Now they do, it kind of goes hand in hand with what we're trying to achieve when it comes to the wellbeing landscape. You know, we need to be able to champion it internally to advocate for it further for our customers, as an example.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, you know, we've all seen examples of organizations who have focused on various perks and initiatives as their kind of well-being strategy. So, for example, offering free fruit to, you know, staff, or, you know, early kind of finishes, you know, on a Friday, for example. And, you know, I'm not saying, you know, for any second that those things are not nice and, you know, they are helpful, but I don't think that it kind of gets under the sort of true skin of what it means to create a culture of well-being. And so I was quite intrigued there to kind of hear you mention about a well-being champion squad. And I just wanted to kind of unpick that a little bit more to understand what their remit is, what their role is, and actually, you know, how does that then sort of tie into the broader piece, as you mentioned, with regards to creating an inclusive culture?
Absolutely. I can speak firsthand on this because I've been part of the in squad on this one. And yeah, it is people literally from across the business. We're circa 200 size business.
Okay.
So, you know, sort of upper end of an SME in traditional classification. And as I said, we're a SaaS business ultimately, right? You know, we've got the traditional departments that do exist, but we're also, as I mentioned before as well, we're a remote business. So as much as I mentioned, we're all sort of focused in terms of what we need to achieve. And there's that sort of general North Star that we all sort of focus on. Having that, having enough proximity to one another is a challenge, but that has been created in the virtual world we live in now. And there is literally somebody from every department within our business as part of that champion squad, led by Dot, who is, of course, on the board. And that, therefore, creates an environment in which it's being mandated that we talk about these things in the right way, and no stone's left unturned, you know, and everybody, regardless of their background, from the D&I perspective, you know, cultural, whatever it might be, but we have a broad range of people within that remit.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, it's a grassroots-led approach in terms of a safe space as well as a vulnerable space, so that people can, but you know, vulnerability supported by safety, so that psychological safety, so that people feel as though, you know, it's not just lip service. This is truly having an impact on the business in terms of the cultural evolution of the organization and how we choose to be, want to be, and are perceived to be. And therefore, we can speak proudly about that when we speak to our customers, our partners, etc. And we can obviously sing that from the rooftops in terms of the organizations we work with and tell them exactly how it's done effectively. And a lot of initiatives have been born from this group. So it's been a real, and as I say, you know, it does take a bit of leadership and implementing it from the top down. It hadn't been there before. It is there now, and it is making material difference in terms of the organization. What I will say is that information is taken straight to the board
mm-hmm.
at the end of every month, and the board, it is part of their monthly board meetings in terms of making sure that that's looked at. It's not just sort of, again, lip service. It's information is taken directly to them, and it's expected of them and mandated to them that they take it on board and do stuff about it, whatever that information feedback might be. It's a constant feedback loop in that respect.
So kind of moving on now to you know, the next thing that I really wanted to kind of sort of ask you about yeah. And that is really just about the key learnings that you've derived so far. So you've spoken obviously about your chief people officer kind of joining, doing the culture audit. You've talked about all the various different initiatives that's been put in place. I would love to hear from you about, you know, the learnings that you've derived so far, because it's a journey, right? And of course, you know, it's always going to be room for further development. Yeah, if you could kind of just expand a bit on that for me, it would be brilliant.
Sure. So yeah, I've got a strong idea on this one. It, you know, it does take time to create a culture where there's a safe space for everyone to talk. It's not a, you know, cookie cutter approach for every person, and certainly every business is different as well. If I think just to, you know, Good Shape as an organization at the moment, you know, we are a diverse business in terms of demographical backgrounds. We're also on that journey where more of that information is being measured, so we don't have everything. But as an example, I can tell you, you know, 72% of our population is female. Average age of the workforce is 38, 27% of the workforce is over 50. As I mentioned, you know, we've got very diverse backgrounds. We've got a remote working culture. So creating an inclusive culture is quite challenging, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it would appear to be on the tin, but as I said, my strong point on this is that I think that managers make the ultimate difference. So we need to do as much as we can and do more to invest in supporting them and make them be role models for vulnerability. It's something I've come to learn more and more as my career has evolved, just in terms of that vulnerability piece. And if you've created a culture where you've created a safe psychological environment and you've created an environment in which vulnerability is applauded, then that is a great trait for a manager, because that will bring out honesty from their people. It also ingratiates them better to their people. And if you've got that type of culture, then you've got a culture of sort of honesty. You've got a culture of feedback. And when people are sort of on the same page in that regard, I believe that's how you sort of further embed it, further, you know, evolve it, align that better to the culture, because it's sort of ingrained within sort of manager to people and above them as well. I think managers are absolutely key to this.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought, isn't it? And you know, I think that there are many ways in which people can show vulnerability in different contexts. And it's kind of funny in a way, because, you know, those are the things that we do quite naturally when we are toddlers and, you know, kids. But actually, you know, as we sort of become more socialized into certain ways of, you know, behaviors, we almost kind of have to then kind of find new ways to learn those sort of habits again. So yeah, it is really interesting. So thank you for sharing that. I guess kind of reflecting back on this journey that, you know, Good Shape have been on, are there any sort of you know, specific sort of challenges or bumps along the way that you've been able to overcome that you would be happy to share, just in terms of challenges that have been experienced in terms of creating a more inclusive culture?
Sure.
And how you've overcome them?
Yeah, of course. So I mean, I think in general, when it comes to inclusive cultures, I think there is a lack of sort of data. So having a sort of data-driven approach can obviously hinder business cases and trying to obviously get particular strategies over the line. Obviously, it takes time to create a culture of psychological safety, where people feel safe to share their personal data. So again, lack of data can hinder things like budget approval when you've got, you know, you might have a great idea, but, you know, if you don't have the evidence for it, then, you know, your FD might not be quite so willing to sign off on it. Mm. So, these things take time. As I mentioned, sort of highlighted before, I think a lack of resources and capacity to delivering across multiple layers and smaller organizations can, you know, limit you in terms of the time you have, you know, cost, quality, you know, these sort of things can be impacted to greater, lesser degrees and just in terms of priorities. I think also, however, you know, as organizations grow, it becomes important that you create a very systemic approach to things. You know, it has to be baked into everything you do. Otherwise, it will go out the window. There's no point in making iterative changes and steps forward to make several back because you didn't carry on with the journey. So as you go through that process, you know, reporting requirements should be increased internally, should be mandated more. I think you have to have a constant finger on the pulse in terms of what's going on. Otherwise, again, you need that constant feedback loop because otherwise it will lose the interest of the sort of, you know, the board. So essential that you don't let this type of stuff fall by the wayside, because you can make great leaps and bounds and efforts in terms of putting the strategy in place. You know, you as I said at the beginning of this, you know, you overcome the sort of cultural resistance, you create that culture of psychological safety, people do start to share more, you do start to execute more, you know, creating this sort of inclusive culture. But you know, you can't take your foot off the gas, as it were. No matter how big or small an organization is, I think, as mentioned before, the manager still makes the biggest difference in terms of how someone feels about their employer. So focusing on developing manager capability and vulnerability, I think that should be maintained throughout.
Thank you for that. And you mentioned a bit earlier on that Good Shape has about 200 employees, and you know, you're sort of, I guess, at the upper end of the spectrum in terms of how you define what an SME is. I just kind of wondered, you know, thinking about it in a, I guess, a broader sense, given your range of experiences at different organizations, how do you feel the challenges might differ for smaller sized SMEs in comparison to what you've talked about? But then equally, where do you think there might be similarities as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you're right. I think there are differences, but I think ultimately, when it comes to inclusive cultures, I don't think there's any reason why they should be polar ends of whether you're a big enterprise business or an SME or even a sort of startup. I think ultimately, you know, you need to create a culture and tone of voice that is inclusive, and you need to do that as early as possible in the business life cycle, and you must start as you mean to go on. I think your senior leaders need to be role models. They need, you know, that vulnerability piece again. I think they need to sort of lead from the front. I believe in that sort of top-down approach, but also that grassroots approach. And there needs to be, a dovetailing of that. And that needs to be captured, and that needs to be identified on quite a consistent basis. Mm-hmm. I think we need to ensure that the design of people framework support inclusivity. You need to get your people involved in co-creation. You need to use different ways to engage and obtain input. ED&I squads, culture, well-being squads, you know, things like that I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And I think if you get the right systems in place, you'll be able to gather data systematically as well. And again, it's that continuous feedback loop. But I do believe, you know, as with all things cultural, everything, you know, ED&I, well-being, has to be baked in, again, systematically, actually into your systems, you know, your IT systems. Everything has to be aligned to what that cultural objective is and that the maintenance of that. And if it is baked into your systems, into your data, into everything you sort of do and everything that you say and how you go about things, then I think it's much easier to achieve and maintain in the long run.
So again, I guess it kind of reinforces the point that you made earlier on about taking a kind of long-term view approach to fostering an inclusive culture, in the sense that, you know, you're not going to see the immediate rewards, but it requires the long-term sort of investment of time, energy, resources, money, to really then kind of keep that momentum going. Is that a fair point?
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't say it better myself. Yeah, absolutely, Lloyd.
Excellent. Thank you. Now kind of moving on, my next question, and that is that, you know, again, based on the experiences that you have had at Good Shape and also within your career in general, what advice would you give to SMEs who are just about to embark on their journey of fostering an inclusive culture?
Yeah, so I think, again, having worked closely with Dot and our people team, watching the sort of journey in terms of what they've undertaken since Dot joined, I think, you know, first and foremost, sort of mentioned this at the beginning, it's conducting a 90-day discovery audit on the business. You get to really understand the true nature of the organization. Some of what I answered in a previous question, but it's about creating a culture and tone of voice that is as inclusive for all of the organization as early as possible. Do the discovery, do the audit, capture that tone of voice, and then start to push that forward from there in terms of how you look to implement that, you know, into the organizations. Senior leaders and managers need training. They need to show vulnerability. Again, that my favorite word of today. I think the inclusive frameworks piece needs to be systematically ingrained into the business and reported on, you know, being a key point. And I think, as has probably been highlighted as a theme throughout, I think it's involving your people at all levels when it comes to co-creation, input, the continuous feedback loop, and that allows you to evolve and adapt with incremental changes as the business evolves. So, you know, again, it's keeping that foot on the pedal. It's holding people accountable as well. As we sort of mentioned, this Rome wasn't built in a day, and these types of initiatives can take time. But if you've gone through a lot of these processes and you've got to that point where you've got the buy-in from the board, you know, we're lucky we have a very bought-in board. Our CEO, Alan Baker, is incredibly, well, a champion of all of this from a cultural perspective. But don't do all that work to get to the point where you've got the buy-in, but you're not then holding people accountable to it. Mm. I had a conversation with one of the big four, and they were saying that they recently moved their ED&I function and their well-being function out of HR, and they put it into their ESG, mm-hmm. environmental social governance, mm-hmm. department. And I was asking them why they did this, and they said, well, what you tend to find is when you are looking for budget for something aligned to well-being and ED&I, from an HR perspective, it is generally seen as being a cost, and therefore HR is held to account by the business. But when they moved the ED&I and well-being functions into the ESG department, mm-hmm. what I was told was that ESG hold the business to account entirely. So they can speak to the board about these types of initiatives, and it could be cultural initiatives and that sort of thing. But, you know, this is obviously in a large organization, mm-hmm. Setup, but I just noticed if you are holding the business to account in terms of wanting to succeed and achieve on some of these sort of initiatives within sort of the cultural framework, mm. then, you know, if you've got to that point, don't let it go, mm. but you've got to keep it up. And as I say, you've got to report on it. You need that continuous feedback loop, and you need to keep them involved. It's like I said, with our sort of well-being squads, that information is taken to the board at the end of each month, and it's mandated on them to do something about it. So I think, you know, don't take your foot off the pedal would be my advice for SMEs.
Yeah. And I guess there's also another point as well, which I'm kind of hearing, which is about having the systems and the processes in place and you know, the infrastructure, if you like, that enables that level of accountability to occur, and also the type of work that needs to be done, i.e. the culture audit and all of that sort of stuff. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, 100%. And, you know, that's what we're seeing here day in, day out, and, you know, realizing the material benefit from that. So absolutely.
Great. Thank you. I want to kind of move on a bit to, I guess, more of a sort of future-facing lens. And I wanted to hear your thoughts about the direction in which you feel equity, diversity, and inclusion is heading in general. How do you perceive, you know, the EDI field developing over time? It's one of those kind of crystal ball type moments of the podcast episode, but, you know, would love to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's funny, isn't it? Because EDI wasn't really talked about in too great detail only five years ago, and I think now, obviously, it's much more ingrained across multiple organizations, and just people are far more aware of it in general, which is fantastic. So I think just in terms of the journey, you know, we're in a much better place than we ever have been, but that will continue to evolve. But I think my sense is that we'll see more focus on belonging as opposed to specific diversity initiatives. So creating a culture where people feel they belong is about, you know, having good organization design, leadership, inclusive policies, that systematic, you know, systematic processes which align with everybody accordingly and equally. I also think, and I'm sure a lot of listeners and people will probably see this as much as I am, but I think equity has become much more talked about. I think it was almost diversity inclusion was the beginning. Equity is now part of that journey. I think it's what ultimately I'm saying is it's okay to treat people differently because we're all different. We're all the same, but we're all different. If it means that they have the same opportunity to succeed, I think that's really critical. I think just in terms of some observations, you know, certainly over the last year or two, that perhaps wasn't there so much in the early days of, you know, ED&I would be that we're seeing much more on neurodiversity. Greater numbers of conversations around it, much more publications, white papers. It's across the media far more frequently as well now, which is fantastic. And you know, and there will be new criterion on this as well. Naturally, things evolve, and again, we're all different, which probably leads into, you know, this point as well, which a sense there will be a greater emphasis on intersectionality and the sum of all our variables. You know. Rather than just labeling according to one specific demographic, it's far more complex than labeling someone as being ED&I on just the obvious things that you perceive. I think, you know, human beings are far more complex than that, and our needs are far more complex, and it doesn't come down just to the sort of, as I say, just like elements that you sort of perceive or understand, because culturally, you know, socially, biopsychosocially, you know, we're all different and we all come at things from different angles. So I think that intersectionality piece is really critical as well. And I think we'll start to hopefully align much better in terms of equity and creating that sort of environment of belonging more as this space continues to grow.
And, you know, it's an interesting point because, you know, although the concepts of equity and intersectionality are easy to understand on the surface, the practicalities of making those things happen within an organization, within, you know, everyday life can present various challenges. And so I guess, you know, how the field continues to evolve definitely, I think, will be encompassing those things. And it's really interesting to kind of, you know, hear your perspectives on that as well. That kind of brings us to the end of this episode. I would like to say just a huge thank you again for sharing some of your thoughts, perspectives about the unique context of working in an SME and the different sort of, you know, strategies, initiatives that your organization undertakes to help foster an inclusive culture. And of course, a huge thank you to our listeners for listening and joining us today. And Luke, is there anything, any kind of final thoughts that you would like to share?
Thanks, Lloyd. I think just to say that there's so many organizations undertaking the same sort of, looking to achieve so much across sort of their cultural objectives, ED&I, wellbeing, etc. And I think there's a plethora of information and a huge amount of SMEs out there. And I'd say don't be, you know, you're not going to know everything. Nobody knows everything, but there's a huge amount of support, articles, information out there. And I think just, you know, seek information, seek support, shows up vulnerability, as I mentioned before. Put your hand up if you don't know everything. Not everybody does, but co-creation and doing it together, that's how we achieve results. That would be my main sort of takeaway point, I think, Lloyd. And yeah, thanks for having me today.
Thank you. And until next time. Thank you, listeners. And if you haven't had an opportunity to listen to previous two episodes, please do so. And if you are enjoying this series, please do share with your contacts, with your friends, and anyone who you feel, you know, may benefit from listening to these episodes. Thank you very much.